Surprised they've written it in English for him.
Are these the Pucho Ultras, the hooligans? Should we go and find out? They don't look very...
Well, the average age is about 65, so I think we're probably quite safe if they are.
Buongiorno, buongiorno. C'è qualche familiare di Salvatore Puccio qua?
Amici.
So they're just friends, Lionel. Right. Chi è che ha fatto la bandiera in inglese?
Amici del paese. Del paese.
Come mai in inglese?
Perché
lui ormai... è con la Sky, no?
So he's in English because he's obviously riding for Sky. Ho capito. Vince la tappa?
No, la tappa è
Santa Lima. No, difficilmente.
Salvatore non la vince perché lui aiuta il capitano.
È un
gregario.
No, è un gregario.
No?
È un gregario di Fulham.
Sì.
Correva a Memphis da bambino.
When Salvatore Puccio was racing here in Memphis.
Di 8 fino a 11 anni io ero nella società dove come cassiere.
This gentleman was the bookkeeper in his junior team.
Unione Velocipedistica, sì, si chiamava. Adesso la società non esiste.
Però ormai vi ha abbandonati.
È
umbro ormai.
Se non ci abbandonavano,
è una cosa normale quella.
He's abandoned them. He's gone to live in Umbria.
Se non ci abbandonava, non sarebbe là.
I was born in Memphis 28 years ago, and then when I was 30 years old, we moved to Assisi because my family, my dad actually found a job there because it was the earthquake time, and he's working for the to make up again. Most of my family is still there, my grandfather, all the cousin, and for sure they come to see me at the finish or along the parkour, and they also lot all the people from the town because it's a not really big city, but just a big town, and they're really enthusiastic to come to see the race. First time ever in the Giro to pass to on that area. With the race, we pass just outside. But if you go in the city, everywhere is a good place to stop because, you know, the Sicily always good food, good place to stay. Of course, also we start the stage 11 from Assisi, and the two boat places see where I was grow, and you know, that's amazing.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at the Giro d'Italia in association with Rafa. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee stops, Rafa exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport. Today, we are in Santa Ninfa.
Cozze ci tene, cozze vicine, nu spigudeci cora, nu spigudeci cora. Cozze ci tene, cozze vicine, nu spigudeci cora, se nu mangiano le femmine.
Where are we, Lionel? Dove siamo?
I'm walking in Memphis.
But do you really feel the way I feel? I'm a bit iffy and a bit on edge because Memphis is...
Well, I can see why Salvatore Puccio moved to Umbria as soon as he was able to, because...
Gritty, isn't it?
It's
very gritty.
It is gritty.
Like a lot of the towns we've seen over the last couple of days.
Well, on our way from the finish this evening to Memphis, which is, around 25 kilometres from the finish, we came over a viaduct that had some traffic lights on it. I mean, I don't know what was going on there, but I worrying that the viaduct was compromised in some way.
We saw some flagrant lawlessness, didn't we?
We did. People just driving through the red lights. I mean, what's going on here? I don't know. You'd think this was the home of the mafia or something where the rules don't count.
I think tonight we should get to the tail of the tapper as quickly as possible and get out of here.
We should also say that I'm Lionel Burney and I'm with Daniel Freeb. Good evening, Daniel.
Good evening.
Yeah, the tail of the tapper then. Stage 5 of the Giro d'Italia from Agrigento to Santa Ninfa, 153 kilometres. A tricky little finish again. There was a four-man break today. Two riders from Trek, Laurent Didier and Ryan Mullen, the Irish champion. They were joined by Eugène Zuppa of Villa Trestina and Andrea Vendrame of Androni. Gianni Savio is having a good Giro so far.
He is. He's holding forth in a regal manner in the press room. He's doing his rounds of the press room. As he's the only team manager who has ever done this. Comes in every single day and gives every single journalist their individualised, tailored press briefing.
I just want to know how he gets his hair, which appears so soft and silvery, to just sit in that perfect position. I mean, I'm the wrong person to talk about people's hair, to be honest. But anyway, those four were away for a lot of the day, and then Vendrame went alone away from the others. Ryan Mullen was struggling a bit on the hill. Vendrame was about a minute clear still with 15 kilometres to go, but there was a lot of action going on behind. One man who fell was Miguel Angel Lopez of Astana, the Astana leader, aiming for a high overall finish, but he's having a really difficult start to this Giro.
I'm in the middle of the tail of the tapper. I can't interrupt that, can I? It's against the rules. But we are in Sicily. Yeah. So we're going to go big on Astana tomorrow, Lionel, because we're going to... turn off now if you want, but we're going to go big on Sky tonight.
Oh, goodness, I can feel people drifting away. No, stay with us. Lopez, he just ran off the road and went into a field, ended up looking a bit dishevelled and lost 43 seconds. So he's giving away time, which he may try to make up tomorrow on Etna, but we shall see. At the finish, well, this afternoon, I said to you on the way when we were talking about the stage, I thought, well, Enrico Battaglin looked very good yesterday, finished third on the stage, won by Tim Wellens. And today he went a couple of places better and won the stage for Team Lotto NL Jumbo. A very famous name in Italy, of course, Battaglin. Giovanni Battaglin won the Vuelta.
Correct.
Did he win the Giro?
No.
No, he didn't. And his name adorns some very fine bicycles these days still, but no relation. Nevertheless, Enrico Battaglin won the stage ahead of Giovanni Visconti, Sicilian rider.
Correct. Sicilian who spent most of his youth in... No, hang on. Born in Turin, spent most of his youth in Sicily, then moved to Tuscany like a lot of the Sicilian riders do when they get to about 15 or 16.
Well, it was a real humdinger of a finish, really. At one point, it looked a bit like a sort of third category road race, didn't it? That everyone, no one was really in charge. Lotto, Fix All, they were trying to set Tim Wellens up for a second consecutive victory, but Team Sky were trying to keep Chris Froome out of difficulty. Froome looked not terribly comfortable on the climb. He's pedalling at a very high cadence, out of the saddle a bit, and didn't look like his usual self. Did well to stick in that group, really, although towards the back of it. As I say, Lopez was really the only loser today. Everybody else was up there looking pretty good. Simon Yates, again, sort of, you know, just ghosting in there in fifth place without looking like he was trying too much.
It occurred to me today what a strong team Mitchelton Scott have. And they've kind of gone under the radar. There's been a lot of focus on how strong Astana are on paper, on the climbs, how strong Sky are. But Jack Haig is getting better with every Grand Tour that he rides, and he was pretty prominent in the finale for Mitchelton Scott. Kreuziger's been riding really well. And Yates, I was told today, is in the best mood anyone in the team has ever seen him in.
My goodness. So he's gone from sort of grumpy to slightly grumpy.
That's harsh. That's harsh in the same way I think we've been a bit harsh about Memphi. I feel slightly contrite now. We've had a very warm reception in the bar we're in, and I'm sure there are untold riches just a few streets away. We're on the outskirts.
Well, we've been given some arancini, which is the rice balls deep fried in breadcrumbs. This looks like some kind of bulgur wheat, I think, we have here, and little bits of this almost focaccia type bread with a rich tomato sauce on the top. Not quite pizza, not quite focaccia, but very tasty. I should just recap who's in the jerseys. Rowan Dennis still in pink, Elia Viviani still in Cicolomino, Barbin still in the King of the Mountains lead, and Max Schachmann still in white. So no real change overall, but an interesting day. And I guess, Daniel, everyone will be relieved to have negotiated the tricky 2 days in Sicily. It will still be tricky on the run to Etna tomorrow, won't it? But at least there's a chance to kind of open up a bit, settle into a rhythm. It's not, once the road starts rising, it's they don't have to watch out for the potholes, don't have to watch out for the quirky aspects of the Sicilian roads.
Yeah, and I think there was a general fear, widespread fear about the possibility that it would rain in Sicily and about rain in the south of Italy in general. We know that it tends to make the roads very greasy and dangerous, but
were a few little spots clouds went a bit grey, and I thought maybe I actually spoke to Matt White this morning, Mitchelton Scott sports director. We'll hear from him a little bit later on about something else, but he did make that point that everyone just hopes to get past Gran Sasso on Sunday and into the sort of middle and bit of Italy where the roads improve a bit without it raining and just adding even more potential for danger.
Yeah, and as for the finale line, it was pretty similar to yesterday. It was ridden race quite aggressively. Pozzovivo was very aggressive, having had a mechanical, or actually I think he was caught behind the crash a few kilometres earlier. And as we said, Mitchelton Scott rode it pretty aggressively. But again, I'm going to repeat myself, but I'm struck by how few sort of fast finishing sort of punchers there are in this race, in a race that's traditionally provided a great platform for those riders. Battaglin and Visconti had a little bit of a gap when they came around the last corner, and Battaglin won fairly comfortably. And you know, it's unusual to see a finish like today's with so little kind of competition between the general classification riders. The sort of sort out all came with a kilometre or two to go, and as I said yesterday, with time bonuses probably going to be some kind of factor in this Giro, it's curious really. And I think there are some teams here who whose only objective is a stage win, and they've got no one on general classification, and it seems slightly odd to me that some of those teams have not brought riders who would have had two great opportunities on very similar finishes today and yesterday.
Yeah, you mentioned the hill. I mean, it was interesting finish in that the hill wasn't the finish. There was the levelling out, and it meant there was the sort out happened, and then there was a conventional sprint, but from a fairly unconventional group of riders. I mean, all the GC riders bar Lopez were up there. But then when you look at Francesco Gavazzi, he's a decent finisher on the flat, and just a couple of places behind him, Domenico Pozzovivo, who you would not think has got a cat in hell's chance of holding his own. You know, he finished in ninth place on what was a flat run-in, but clearly looking and feeling good after the climb, where he's very prominent.
Well, Pozzovivo's talking about aiming for the podium in Milan. Never finished on the podium in the Giro, but I mean, he's 35 years of age now. It struck me today that he probably, when he joined Bahrain Merida in the winter, he probably wasn't absolutely guaranteed of a place as leader in the Giro, and he's kind of fallen on his feet there, in the sense that, you know, Nibali is not riding, and he's got an entire team at his service. Cobrelli's not riding, so they're not really looking at the sprint finishes. And it's a decent team as well, people like Paul Anch, and Nibali's brother is riding pretty well, Antonio Nibali. I think we're going to hear about him and from him in a kilometre zero 40 piece start coming up.
Yeah, that's the Bahrain Merida team, of course, you're referring to. And another rider who's had a pretty seamless opening few days is the defending champion, Tom Dumoulin.
Yeah, these stages I have not much to win, but a lot to lose, and we didn't lose anything, so that's good.
Tomorrow, do you know this climb, this climb of Etna that we did?
And, no.
What are your expectations for tomorrow?
That is going to be really hard. I know it's more difficult than the other side that we did last year, but yeah, we'll see how it goes. Today I wasn't feeling good, but hopefully that means good legs for tomorrow.
Well, Lionel, that was first of all, we heard the familiar sounds of Tom Dumoulin fans from actually last year. We kind of cheated, but you know, we'd missed that, hadn't we? We haven't heard it yet. We haven't heard any strains of Tommy Dumoulin yet in this Giro, and it was such an earworm for us last year, wasn't it, that we felt we needed.
Admitting to podcast doping, well, using last year's crowd noise.
But
everything else is authentically from today.
But more significant, you heard Tom Dumoulin there talking about how he didn't feel good today. Today was not a particularly comfortable day for him. And it's refreshing that Tom Dumoulin is still retains this kind of naivety and this kind of transparency, which is very unusual for general classification leaders, and is certainly very different from what we hear from Chris Froome. Chris Froome keeps his cards very close to his chest, doesn't give anything away. If he's not feeling too good, he won't talk about it. And Tom Dumoulin really can't help himself, can he? He really does wear his heart on his sleeve, and you know, he said that he hopes he feels better tomorrow. He also said that he doesn't know tomorrow's climb up Mount Etna, which, again, is almost advertising the kind of chinks in his armour.
Here's a question for you, Daniel. Who was the last rider to successfully defend his Giro title?
It was Miguel Indurain. Correct?
A San Francisco.
A community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Good morning, the Cycling Podcast. It's Vittorio, friend of yours from Rovereto. Did you consider Maximilian Schachmann for Pedaleur de Charme? Cheers from Italy.
Thank you to Rafa for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. If you would like a Rafa Pedaleur de Charme jersey or t-shirt or cap or Pedaleurs de Charme t-shirt, go to rafa.cc or you can go to thecyclingpodcast.com/shop and it will take you straight to the range of clothing that we have available. The first Pedaleur de Charme t-shirt of this Giro d'Italia will be presented to a rider at the weekend. We've had such a busy few days, we've not really asked for nominations yet, but what we want from you, the listeners, is nomination for any Pedaleur de Charme that you have noticed over the last few days. Let us know on Twitter or Facebook. We'll draw up a poll at the end of tomorrow's stage, and then there'll be a vote, and then the winner of that vote will be presented with a Rafa Pedaleur de Charme t-shirt. Daniel, I asked you the question, who was the last rider to defend the Giro title successfully, and you were absolutely right. It was Miguel Indurain, Spanish rider who won in 1992 and 93. He also won the Tour de France in both of those years. Can the double be done? I mean, let's not go too early. But
what's next, Lionel? It's a new feature, isn't it?
I'm dreading this.
Learn Italian with Lionel and Guido Piovene's classic 1957 travelogue, Viaggio in Italia.
I catanesi lo amano come il popolo amaccio che si associa a tutti i suoi ricordi e anche alla sue sventure. Gli serve da barometro. Il fumo indica la direzione del vento. Nuvole a strate e meta costa sono annunci attrici di pioggia. Un cappuccio intorno alla cime d'altro che non ricordo bene. Il piccolo Vesuvio ha un andamento regolare, abitudinario, l'Etna è imprevedibile.
The Catanese love Etna, as a people loves anything it associates with its memories and its misadventures. They use it as a barometer, the smoke indicating the direction of the wind, stratus clouds midway down the mountain's waist presaging imminent rain, a little hood over the top meaning something else, though I can't recall exactly what. Little Vesuvius has habitual regular rhythms. Etna is unpredictable.
Who did it best?
Wow.
I mean, who did it best?
So just to explain, that passage comes from one of the classic books ever written about travels in Italy by a journalist called Guido Piovene. In 1957, he spent 3 years travelling up and down Italy. We're only going to spend 3 weeks travelling up and down Italy. But I thought it was a good way for Lionel to polish his Italian skills.
That's a little bit advanced for where I'm at the moment.
We'll keep them slightly shorter, but you know, we will continue to pick out a few, the odd passage that relates to the Giro route. That passage related to Etna. We're going to Etna tomorrow. Quite evocative. What's the weather going to be like? Is there going to be that cappuccio, the hood, top of the mountain?
Well, we saw from a distance the snow is up there at the top. You tweeted saying that the race will finish just below where the snow starts.
A little bit below,
it will be a day to wrap up warm, I suspect, up there, because it was pretty chilly up there last year, even though it's warm down below. Remember, they're doing a different road up to the one last year. Jan Polansch won on Etna last year. It was a bit of a damp squib, wasn't it, the stage? It never really ignited. There was a headwind from memory. And a lot of people now reflecting that it was a mistake not to try and take some time there. It's a summit finish. There's an opportunity there. Just because it's early in the race, I mean, this is another couple of days on than it was. I think it was stage four last year, stage six this year. It's only a couple of days, so it's in the same sort of...
Stage five, I think, last year, actually.
Right, yeah.
Was it stage five? Yeah, did we do two stages in Sicily last year or just one?
We did...
Just one,
I think.
Yeah, so
maybe
it was stage four.
I think it was stage four, yeah. Anyway, it was a missed opportunity, and I spoke to Mitchelton Scott sports director Matt White this morning. He obviously has Simon Yates in looking absolutely terrific. It's very early days, but he hasn't put a foot wrong for a moment so far. Got an incredibly strong team behind him. I mean, Roman Kreuziger, for example, Esteban Chavez has been on the podium at the Giro himself in the past. You know, even Jack Haig, who took a hell of a beating in a crash on the first day, he posted a picture on Instagram or Twitter of him, you know, battered black and blue, but still looking fine on the bike. But I asked Matt what he was expecting from the Etna stage, and he said that there's going to be no mood to make the same mistakes as last year.
No, he's in a good position. He's in a really good position at the moment. I know it's a long way to go, but yeah, this Giro could be won by seconds, and so if you can take any on your rivals, it's always a positive. It's a solid climb tomorrow, quite different from the side of Etna we've used in the past, but I think what makes tomorrow hard, and depending on how hard that race is, before we actually start climbing, we've got about 14 kilometres of climbing up from the basically sea level until the climb proper starts. So we rode the proper climb on the rest day in the afternoon, and they've actually hot mixed most of the last climb. So the road's in perfect condition to the line. So I think it'll be a big fight until the final climb, and I'm really curious to see how our guys go, because I think it's crunch day.
In terms of tactics, I mean, the fact that Froome, Aru, Lopez have all lost a bit of time, need to try and get some of that back, and also the fact that Dumoulin has started so well, no one can underestimate him or think he's going to get dropped after what he did last year. So it's a real different dimension to the race, isn't it?
It is. Tom really flew under the radar for a period last year, but he's coming in as obviously the favourite here, and he's certainly shown that he's come in super form. But I think tomorrow, if anyone has a bad day, and I think we'll see this general line of attack right throughout the tour, if someone's on a bad day, a lot of people have benefit in gaining from it. So the climb really does kick up hard at about 5.5k to go, and I think you're going to see a big split there, and then it levels off and goes up in a couple of different ramps to the line. But no, we've made no mistake, no hiding it, the fact that, you know, if we see Tom on a bad day or Chris on a bad day, then we have to pounce, because we know we're not as good as a time trial as those guys. So 20 seconds here, 15 seconds there, over the 3 weeks it will make a difference.
Well, Matt White there giving the impression that this is the first big battleground, and they're not going to hesitate if there's an opportunity to gain something, because seconds can soon turn into minutes. And of course, anyone who's not as good at time trialing as Tom Dumoulin has to gain time here. I thinking about Mitchelton Scott and how they can ride, they've got some allies really, because there's going to be the likes of Fabio Aru, Lopez now, Chris Froome even, who are going to want to start making up time rather than keep losing it at some point. Maybe that will start tomorrow.
Talking of Fabio Aru, did we not get a call from a listener about Fabio Aru and his tactics yesterday?
We did. This is Richard from London.
Hello there, Cycling Podcast. My name is Richard. I'm loosely speaking a friend of the podcast. Just a couple of things I wanted to say. First was Tuesday's stage in Sicily, UAE. What were their tactics all about? Blew the race to shreds, about 100 kilometres to go, made it really hard, put a few riders in difficulty, then sat up. And then their young pup, Valerio Conti, who, is he very tactically astute? I mean, he goes off on his own with 10 kilometres to go for a very tough finale with climbs and very technical, where we knew that a lot of the top riders and their teams would be making it very fast and very hard. And the chances of him holding them off for 10 kilometres seemed extremely unlikely. Was that the UAE game plan? It seemed very odd. The second point, I've just listened to this morning's Kilometre Zero, and something that Joe Dombrowski said struck me as interesting. We've spoken quite a lot recently about the number of crashes in professional cycling these days, and The reasons for that is it that the riders ride too close together? Are helmets a factor? But something he said about information overload struck me as potentially quite interesting in this regard, because he said that a lot of the riders are using their Garmins as maps for information on altitudes, what's around the next corner, etc., etc. And could it be that their attention is divided between, you know, the road around them, the riders around them, and the information they're getting on their screen? I thought that was maybe quite an interesting thing to think about, and whether it was a factor in the number of crashes that we see. Anyway, that's all. I'll be listening with interest, chaps. Keep up the good work. Bye.
Yes, that was Richard the Buffalo Moor with some excellent points about Team UAE's tactics. I think we addressed that briefly in the podcast last night, but they were obviously trying to set up Conti for an attack. I mean, it's a bike race, well, Richard.
I think they were trying to set up Ulissi. It was my reading that they, you know, they wanted to string the group out a bit. Conti was dangerous. Obviously, with Conti down the road, UAE didn't have to do any work. Someone else would take it on, and then they were hoping to launch catapult Ulissi in the closing stages, which they did today. They tried to launch Ulissi, but he doesn't seem to be in particularly great form.
No, he looked a little bit sluggish today, and of course yesterday he didn't really do anything to off the back of that Conti move. Anyway, if you want to be like Richard and be on the cycling podcast, you can leave us a message on Facebook Messenger or on WhatsApp. And if you leave a voice message using this number, +44 797 133 8205, leave us a voice message, keep it short and to the point. We're thinking of doing some kind of points of view style additional bonus show on the rest day. We've not thought this through. Who knows how this will go, but if you want to contribute to that with a message about our coverage or about the Giro in general, or ask us a question about anything, we'll give it a go at answering them when we're at our rest day Agriturismo somewhere in wherever we'll be. That number again is +44 797 133 8205, and that's on WhatsApp.
We're going to talk a bit more about Etna, aren't we, Lionel? And we were talking to, well, a few Directors Sportifs this morning, not just Matt White, about what to expect tomorrow. Nicolas Portal is Team Sky's director, Chris Froome's director. Froome, as we know, as we've discussed, hasn't looked particularly convincing so far. He's lost a fair bit of time. Still, I presume, recovering to some extent from that injury that he sustained on the Recce in Israel. But I asked Portal whether tomorrow we were going to see the first big sort out in the GC.
So there's a lot of speculation, obviously, about Chris's condition, but looking ahead to tomorrow and Etna, is the memory of last year when the race went up Etna and not much happened, is that a bit misleading? Do you expect a big GC sort out tomorrow?
Yeah, in general, I don't like to compare, you know, what's happening in a few different races, or there's always different kind of scenario. But it's the first summit finished, that is something sure, is a fact. And We saw yesterday, 2 days ago, and a few riders also went to see the climb. It's a different climb than last year. They got some steep section. There's not that much open, so I don't think the wind will have the same effect that last year, when, you know, it was a lot of attacks, obviously, and it was still a big bunch. So let's see. But it's still for, I'm talking for the top guys out here. It's not like a crazy climb. What you don't want is to lose time on this this climb. You just, if you're not ready yet on the top, because you're going to reach the peak later, you just want to follow. And if you want to attack, you try to attack and make sure, in case you've got the legs to follow a counterattack. So, and it will be probably the same thing from most of the GC contender. They want to race, but at the same time they don't want to lose everything or lost 30 seconds stupidly because, wow, I went full on, and actually I get a counterattack at 200 meters or 2k to go, and I lost 10 seconds. So it will be, you know, like cat and mouse a little bit, you can say that. But still, still a hard hand-on climb, yeah.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Independent research shows 10% of sports nutrition products fit get a professional rider banned. Trust Science in Sport, the world's highest standard of banned substance testing.
Thank you to Science in Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. If you'd like to get 25% off all of their products, go to scienceinsport.com, and when you check out, the code is SISCP25. SISCP25. Now, Daniel, the Giro is 5 days old, and we've talked a little bit about Sky, but not all that much, really, considering Chris Froome comes here as a reigning Tour de France and Vuelta a España champion. He's coming here to complete the set, possibly as the first part of a double attempt, winning the Giro and the Tour de France in the same summer. And, of course, with this adverse analytical finding case for excess salbutamol in a urine sample taken in the final week in the Vuelta a España, Froome, of course, maintains that he didn't exceed the limit of salbutamol that he was entitled to take according to the rules, but the sample has kind of triggered a kind of orange flag and sets in motion this very complicated state of affairs where an adverse analytical finding is announced to the rider confidentially and not released to the public. But it was leaked to the public, and of course it's all being played out in the public domain. But on the bike, Daniel, yesterday there were a few cracks in the Sky armoury, weren't there?
We saw that discussion, didn't we, between the King Kenny Elizonde, Team Sky Domestique, and Chris Froome at the finale, and we said we would endeavour to find out what was going on and what had happened and why Froome had lost King Kenny's wheel. So that's what we did.
Yeah, the thing is, we were quite far back. It was really tricky, like in the turn, and it went in my wheel. We were moving up, and then when we were like, let's say 20 S position, I saw like they did a split with Orica, or there was a split in Orica. I don't know how it happened. And so it was a bit panic session because there was Chavez, a GC guy. So I went, and I make sure it was in my wheel during all the corners and stuff and thing. But no, it was just a straight line. So I was like, okay, no, we can't lose my wheel at this point. So I went, and in the same time, Nico Portal said, go, you can go. And so I went, but eventually, just before the corner, a rider put him in a barrier. When I passed, someone tried to take my wheels, so he had to brake. And we are still doing the effort to come back on the GC, but he was not in the wheel anymore.
So Chris is fine, you're fine?
Oh, obviously, yeah, we have a debriefing, and he was happy. He was happy of how we managed the whole day and how we did it. Just with the heat, you know, after the race, we were just disappointed. You know, like it would have been so good if we would have been in my wheel in perfect position, but that back racing, I guess.
So Lionel, all sounded innocent enough, didn't it? But again, today Froome was lagging a bit further back than probably he would have liked, and he was a bit more isolated than he probably would have liked in that group, the front group, as they came into Santa Ninfa. I wouldn't be surprised if he's right up there at the business end of things tomorrow on Etna, and I wouldn't be surprised if Sky are the team that ultimately take control on Etna. We've seen it before. He's looked unconvincing various times this spring, or we've thought he's looked unconvincing only for the sort of Team Sky train to reassemble on the big mountain stages and still to set the pace. And the Italians, in the Italian press, they're enjoying, as they always do, they enjoy sort of portraying the Giro as this sort of mystical object, this indecipherable code that someone like Chris Froome, who's never really had a good go at the Giro before, and will not be able to understand. It's kind of self-flattery.
So you can win the Tour and the Vuelta, but until you come to the Giro, there was all you sorts can't
of
really
that.
Get it. Yeah.
No, there was all sorts of that in today's papers. In Tutto Sport, there was a piece that said that adaptation is not in Chris Froome's DNA, and he's struggling to adapt to the Giro. And after 4 days, only one of which had been in Italy. But that's a narrative that will certainly play out a bit like the narrative about Sky being robotic and riding to Watts. The Italian commentators, the Italian journalists hate that idea, and that is a stick that they beat Sky with on a regular basis.
Well, this afternoon I spoke to Team Sky's principal, Dave Brailsford. He was at the Team Sky bus watching the finish of the stage on the TV.
Casually. So yeah, everyone's been trying to speak to him for months. You just up your rock.
Well,
and the doors are thrown open.
And then I said to you, you said, where are you? And I said, well, I'm down at the team buses. And you said, oh, I wanted to go to the team buses. Well,
I didn't want a private audience with Sir Dave necessarily. I just wanted a lift.
It was perfectly innocent.
Well, I had a few questions for him. The issue is that he can't talk about the salbutamol case because they are told that it's going to be the while the investigation is ongoing, that confidentiality and the process should be respected. And I can, you know, people who think that this is the tip of some kind of iceberg will no doubt be rolling their eyes at that. I mean, it's always the same with Dave Brailsford. We've heard it before. He's a stickler for the process. In on occasions like this. So he didn't really talk too much about where we are with this case. There is a rumour flying around, isn't there, Daniel, that perhaps it might be over sooner than we think.
Well, one of our colleagues in the press room, Raymond Kirchhoffs, is very confident that it's going to be over soon. He writes for The Telegraph, Raymond does, and he has got very good sources at the UCI generally, particularly at the UCI. But this information could have come from another source. But he's very confident that Chris Froome's case is going to be resolved in the next few days. And not only that, but Chris Froome's going to be absolved.
Well, I'm hearing is that that Team Sky would be pretty surprised by that, but not that they think Chris Froome shouldn't be cleared, but that time frame is realistic because this case has gone on for months, and obviously people are wondering exactly where it's at. And my understanding is that it hasn't really started yet. They've been setting out the frames of reference in terms of how the case will be heard and who, you know, how it will actually be playing out, rather than actually getting into the nitty gritty of the detail. Now, we'll play some of what Dave Brailsford said in a moment, but talk to him a little bit about the few days in Israel. And like everyone, he was a little bit unsure about how that would go, but came back with a different impression of Israel as a country than the one perhaps he had before he went. While he was there, I gather he rode to Bethlehem. I did.
Was King Kenny one of the three kings?
Very good. Oh, very good. Oh, that spoils my joke, really. But I was going to say, was he in search of some kind of divine intervention by cycling to Bethlehem? He said he got there and there's a guard at the, you know, an armed guard saying, what are you doing? He's riding his bike in his Sky kit, and he managed to get into Bethlehem, but had a little look around and decided perhaps, you know, riding around on his bike, he didn't feel 100%.
No room for the inn, was there?
no room for the inn. Oh dear, I'm trying to be serious here, Daniel, on a serious story. Another couple of things that I kind of picked up a vibe on, you know, he didn't really want to talk about, but I don't think Mauro Venni's comments on the eve of the Giro were terribly helpful. I gather that the negotiations over the start fee for Chris Froome were still going on 3-4 weeks ago, you know, so for Venni to say he felt deceived, you know, yeah, the agreement for Froome to come here was being discussed while Sky knew that there had been this adverse analytical finding. But it's all been in the public domain when the actual nitty-gritty of the contract has been, discussed and agreed, so I gather. Now, you know, that's one side of the story. You know, Venni obviously has his point of view, he had his say. But what struck me is that Froome, other than saying he did not exceed the permitted dose of salbutamol, really has kept counsel, and so has Dave Brailsford, and so have Team Sky. And I started by asking if it was a risk for Froome to come into the Giro below his best.
I think there's a bit of a... I wouldn't say calculated risk, but I think, you know, you've got to step back and take a look at a bigger picture and think, okay, we know that if you come in too fit, with too much form, too far ahead, as it were, at this moment in time, it would be quite challenging then to go all the way through and try and look at the double, which is what, you know, the whole purpose of this is, I guess. So with that in mind, I think there are risks involved, but hopefully, any time lost in this first part equals opportunity potentially in the third week of this race, where it's going to get really, really hard. Yeah, it's not been easy. I mean, there's no denying that. I think it's been challenging, I think, and whilst we try to maintain, you know. from a, I think the interesting thing is when something like that happens, you know, you've got to sort of step back and look at a situation and try and think, okay, well, how are we going to manage this? What are we going to do? And certainly try to let the team operate as normal. Just have a very small number of people involved on a sort of day-to-day basis, and try and isolate that, the management of that, away from the rest of the day-to-day operational side of the team. So everybody just kind of keeps going business as usual, which isn't always easy, but that's how we've tried to do it. We're desperately trying not to allow it. I mean, obviously, you know, I'm kept across everything and involved on a, like you say, on pretty much a day-to-day basis, and there's a lot going on. There's a lot of information to take in, and it's quite complex. But on the other hand, that's for me to, you know, deal with and work with. And like I say, try and isolate the rest of, you know, everybody else, or insulate the team, if you like, away from this, and make sure that they can focus and get on with the job in hand. You know, I must say it's quite remarkable, you know, his ability to focus on the race here with that going on in the background. But he, like we, genuinely believe that he didn't go over that allowable dose, and I think that's what gives you the... If you like, you know, when you're really fighting for something that you believe in, and you think, actually, hold on a minute, there's something not right here, in terms of all of this, I think it gives you that conviction. And I absolutely 100%, categorically, have got confidence in the fact that, you know, he never went over that allowable dose.
I asked Brailsford if the case had affected the team's preparation for the Giro and Froome's focus on the race.
Yeah, it is. I'm not going to lie, it's frustrating, but equally, I think at the outset of this, you know, when I was initially informed, I was told quite clearly that this, it was a confidential matter, and that it wasn't to be shared, and I respected that. And so for quite a time, actually, a considerable, you know, couple of months, really, that, you know, it's not the first time that we've been in a situation where we've got confidential information. And confidential doesn't mean partially confidential or just, you know, tell a few people it's okay kind of thing. It's either confidential or it's not. And I'd like to think that I respected that, which was challenging in the team, you know, because obviously running the team is normal. And then obviously that with that in the background, that was uncomfortable at times, I guess. But still, you know, that's the way it is. You accept it, not a problem. And then when the case actually started, you know, it's pretty clear to us that, you know, the rules and around it basically are that you shouldn't talk about the actual content and the actual procedures and the actual nitty-gritty, if you like, of the case itself. And so we've refrained from doing that and stuck to what the process and the rules and regulations say, and respected that. But you are right, there are times where you see things which are reported or see things which are wildly inaccurate, and then there's a lot of misunderstanding, and the temptation is to say, well, okay, you know, let's at least try and educate or support or share some thinking. But ultimately we don't want to risk stepping over that line, so we've decided to sit tight and respect that sort of confidentiality, really, and not comment or give a running commentary on the process, which is, it has been frustrating. Yeah,
we'll play the second half of the interview with Dave Brailsford in either tomorrow or Friday's show.
Interesting stuff there from Dave Brailsford. I'm not sure it's you know, added a great deal to my understanding. The case, probably, it may have a long way to go. It may be resolved in a few days, but what is for certain is that Chris Froome doesn't look his usual self, and hearing Brailsford dare say that this is possibly the first part of a double. Well, we talked about that last year with Nairo Quintana, and I mean, Froome doesn't look to me to be in Giro winning shape at this moment, but who knows, time tomorrow we might have a very different opinion.
No, but he didn't look like he was in Tour winning shape at the start of last year's Tour or in last year's Dauphiné, so I can see how it's respecting a similar sort of trajectory to the one that ultimately gave him a Vuelta a España title last year and a Tour de France title. Who knows whether he'll keep the Vuelta. We also had an interesting letter from a listener, didn't we, suggesting that maybe he's riding the Giro to simulate last year's Vuelta with the ultimate goal of doing this
the pharmacokinetic test
at the end of the Giro.
I gather that is not the case, and that is not a feasible option. This pharmacokinetic test would have to be done under monitored and controlled conditions, and I did ask Brailsford whether there was anyone hanging around Team Sky monitoring what was going on. But really, when you think about it rationally, as far as Team Sky and Chris Froome say, the reason that he kind of upped the dose of salbutamol from his normal level to a bit higher, but within the threshold, that is permitted in the final week of the Vuelta, was because he was struggling with a chest infection. He was also on antibiotics to try and shift that chest infection. Now, in order to simulate the conditions, one Grand Tour and another are completely different. I mean, the weather here is different to how it was in Spain. It was very hot last year in Spain. There's all sorts of discussions about the effects of dehydration on the way that salbutamol is processed by the body. It's one of those things, isn't it? When in January we saw that Chris Froome was posting all these huge rides in South Africa, we did have somebody speculating, a listener speculating, that perhaps that was the pharmacokinetic test. But it wasn't, and nor is this, I gather, because if you think about it, in the final week of the Giro, Froome would have to up his salbutamol without a chest infection, we assume, and take antibiotics in order to replicate the conditions. And of course, the idea of proving that his levels could, you know, go up, have a spike, if that occurred during this Giro, it wouldn't clear him for the Vuelta. It would mean there'd be another adverse analytical finding from the Giro. So it's a pretty complicated case, but just trying to replicate last year's Vuelta here, no, that's not happening as far as I can tell. Anyway.
On to Etna. Long old day tomorrow, Lionel. We've got to get off that mountain. We've got to get over the Strait of Messina. We've got to do a kilometre zero. We've got to, you know, we've got all sorts on
you
tomorrow.
Make it sound awful.
No, it's going to be terrific. It's going
to
be terrific.
I do remember last year we had to record the episode in the queue to get on the ferry and then on the ferry. I can imagine the same thing happening tomorrow. But we'll find out.
Let's go get it. Let's go get it, Lionel.
Until then, thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, Lionel.
A community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa. Ci gira nella tenevo giardina che la raccolgo.